today. What Iran's response to the killing of Qasem Soleimani means for the world. And we hear from Parliament's youngest MP. It's 2 weeks since the US assassinated the Iranian general Qasem Soleimani. In the days after his death, the world waited to see how Iran would react.
Iran was walking a tightrope here. They needed to do something that won them the respect of their population, that made it seem like Qasem Soleimani had been revenged, while on the other hand, not prompting the US to strike back in a way that would lead to an escalation and eventually a war, because Iran's leaders are not suicidal. They know that they would ultimately lose a war with the US. So it was a complex thing to pull off. And at first, it appeared that they might have succeeded.
Iran has fired missiles at American forces in Iraq in retaliation for the killing of General Qasem Soleimani. President Trump said casualties and damage were being assessed, but in his words, so far, so good.
And of course, now we know it was a historic failure.
Welcome back, everyone. Aside from the Iranian missile strikes on US bases, we're learning that a Boeing 737 passenger plane has crashed in Iran.
What happened next was completely unexpected and has had ramifications not just for Iranians, but for the rest of the world. From The Guardian, I'm Rachel Humphreys. Today in Focus, mistakes and dangerous miscalculations in the wake of Qasem Soleimani's death. Michael, it was last Wednesday morning, just hours after Iran had attacked US air bases in Iraq, that we first heard a passenger plane had crashed in Iran. Do you remember when you first heard about it?
I do remember. I saw it pop up on Twitter.
Michael Safi is an international correspondent for The Guardian based in the Middle East.
And I mean, you must remember this came at a time when we were awaiting possible American reprisals, trying to figure out if anyone had died in this attack. And, you know, amongst all of this chaos, I remember seeing a very brief snap at about 7 a.m. Iran time.
Now, those reports suggest it was a Boeing 737, and early indications from Iran state TV say it was likely brought down by mechanical issues, but they didn't explain that point any further.
The Iranians were very quick in calling it a technical issue. And I think at the time, we were willing to believe that because the idea that it wasn't was just far too complicated on an already very complicated morning. But then as I started to kind of do a bit of research, I found, for example, that the plane had been serviced only a few days before, that this model of plane has a very good safety record. So there was this kind of building sense throughout the day of like, hold on a second, what are the chances? Do you think this may have been shot down deliberately or accidentally? And the next day, my colleague Peter Beaumont and I began to pore over these forums where pilots, professional pilots, can like discuss what is often very kind of arcane and sort of technical elements of flight. But they had a thread on this forum where they were discussing this particular crash. And I started flicking through it and found myself drawn into this like rabbit hole. I mean, these guys were looking at it in such intricate detail. They were pointing to the fact that there were holes in the fuselage that appeared to have been made by shrapnel. They talked about the fact that a pilot would not turn right for safety because Tehran is ringed by mountains on their side. In fact, he would turn left where it was much clearer. And then, most suspiciously, there was these photos that were emerging of what looked like missile debris from a Russian-made missile that had been sold to Iran's Revolutionary Guards about a decade ago. And then by evening on Thursday, Iran time, the government story appeared to crumble.
We're following breaking news. The United States and key allies now seem convinced that Iran shot down a Ukrainian passenger plane.
This video came out.
New video obtained by CNN purportedly shows the moment of impact.
Showing what looked to be some kind of projectile flying towards the plane, hitting it. It appeared to have been on fire. And then the plane veers out of the camera's frame and you hear an explosion.
Some of that footage that has come out subsequently is actually very difficult to watch. It's such a tiny speck of light in the dark of the sky, but when you think that there's over 100 people on board, it's very scary to watch. What do we know about who was travelling on it?
Yeah, I mean, we kind of get used to it after these sorts of tragedies, seeing these like composite pictures of dozens of people who have been killed. But of course, behind every one of them is a family that won't be the same again, and people who are, you know, living through probably the worst periods of their lives. The plane included huge numbers of Iranian dual nationals, so people who were also part of the Iranian diaspora in Canada, in Germany, in Sweden, in the UK. Canada in particular had citizens aboard, and some of their stories have emerged since the crash, including a young couple, Pune Gorgi and Arash Puzarabi, who flew to Iran to be married on the 1st of January in front of their families. Now, they were returning to the University of Alberta in Canada, where both of them were studying computer science, and so they were newlyweds, and tragically they died together on that flight.
You know, they were all our close friends. It's so sad. I want peace for the world. That's it.
When did you finally get some clarity on what had actually happened to the plane?
All at once on Saturday, the Iranian government came out with an admission saying, actually, this was us. One of our members fired a missile, and they said it was an unforgivable error. This was a horrific tragedy, and that they basically were to blame.
Do we know anything about the person who shot the plane down?
Well, we don't know a name or anything just yet, but the Revolutionary Guards aerospace chief, a man called Ali Hajizadeh, made a very frank speech on Saturday. Hajizadeh explained, you know, what was going through this guy's head when he shot the plane down.
Unfortunately, because of a hasty decision of one person, this great disaster happened.
He said that they had been told that the airspace had been cleared. This man who was operating the air defense system was under the impression that the Americans had fired a cruise missile. And he sees this object traveling from about a distance of 19 kilometers away. And he said that the ordinary procedure is that when you lock onto a target, you seek approval from some of your superiors to shoot it down. Now, he says, for some reason, maybe it was jammed, maybe the line was busy, this guy was unable to seek that approval. So he's sitting there alone. He knows cruise missiles are coming. And he said he had about 10 seconds to choose whether he shoots this or not. Now, that's their side of the story, but that's the best account that we have.
And the Iranian judiciary have said several arrests have been made over the crash.
That's right. On Tuesday, Iran announced that they had made some arrests in connection with this missile attack. And we heard the same day that one of those arrested may have been the person who actually filmed the video. Now, I've been in touch with the Iranian activist who actually leaked that video. Now, he maintains to me that that person hasn't been arrested. He says that his source, who he describes as a hero, is safe. But certainly, it appears that this person is now a marked man. The Revolutionary Guards have shown an unprecedented level of contrition about this.
I was in the west of the country following the completion of missile strikes against the US bases. And I heard the heart-wrenching news of a Ukrainian Airlines flight crash. When I confirmed what had happened, I really wished I could die myself.
Their leaders have said that, you know, they wish they had died on the plane. I mean, all of that is very rare for an organization that's usually very aggressive, very hardline, operates largely in secrecy from the Iranian public. It's been interesting to see how it's played out.
That response is very interesting. Why do you think it's played out like that? Is it because of international pressure?
I think it's more likely to be because of domestic pressure. I think that it will show that even the Revolutionary Guards understand what an awful mistake this was and admit that they had done it and be humble and seek forgiveness from people and hope that that will calm public anger.
I mean, that didn't happen. And this week we've heard about some extraordinary expressions of anger and upset towards the Iranian regime, in some cases from very prominent figures.
It's been very interesting. I mean, Iran is a place where dissent is not uncommon. I mean, people do voice their anger with the government, but it often keeps within very strict boundaries. What we've seen in the last week is one of Iran's most popular female actors, Taraneh Elidousti, come out with, you know, a scathing message on Instagram saying that Iranians are not citizens but captives. We've had several anchors of state TV news programs quit. One of them said, that I'm sorry for having lied to you all for 13 years. I mean, this is a major blow to the government's credibility, to the credibility of the state media. There's been this like nationwide feeling of revulsion and disgust that is sort of rare in its vehemence.
And Iranians have been protesting too.
Well, people started to fill the streets of Iran within hours of this announcement. This was a kind of moment that symbolised a lot of what Iranians do not like about their government, which is the secrecy, the incompetence, the seeming lack of care for the lives of their citizens.
It was within these protests that the UK ambassador to Iran was arrested. What happened?
You know, it's often said that the last place that Britain is a global superpower is in the minds of Iran's ruling class. So many in Iran remain suspicious of the UK as a kind of puppeteer, a meddler in Iranian affairs, which dates back to the colonial era when the UK certainly was a meddler in Iranian affairs. And so the British ambassador to Tehran found himself caught up in this.
Rob McCare was accused of attending an illegal gathering, a charge he denies. The ambassador was quickly released, but summoned today to the foreign ministry.
It's a propaganda opportunity for the government. Many within the regime, hardliners, have called for him to be expelled. They've burned his effigy. The whole episode is much more likely to have just been a mistake than something deliberate, but the Iranians are not missing their opportunity to play it up to maximum impact.
And in the last few days, Michael, how have the Iranian authorities been responding to these protests?
Well, they've been responding forcefully. So in Tehran, tear gas was fired, rubber bullets were fired. We've seen videos that show sidewalks stained with blood. Thankfully, we haven't seen the kind of mass killing that we know took place in November after the much larger protests. In this case, it appears that the Iranian government has taken a more careful approach. There haven't been reports of any deaths. They haven't shut down the internet, for example, which is interesting to note that this time they feel under more pressure. They feel that they have, you know, less leverage to respond violently, and indeed perhaps less need to respond violently, because the protests we've seen so far have been relatively small. They haven't been the mass broad-based demonstrations that we saw in November that probably would have worried the government a lot more.
And yeah, I spoke to you last year about those protests, Michael, which was about a fuel rise. Do you get a sense at all that the anger we're seeing from people in Iran now has built partially on that anger that was present then?
I mean, I think in Iran over the past few years, we've seen the scale and the intensity of protests grow. So there were significant protests in 2017, in 2018, obviously last year. And then we've seen this year begin in a way that is just, I mean, a horror start for the government. They've had a top general assassinated. They had an opportunity to kind of ride a wave of nationalism after that and have totally bungled it. It just contributes to a sense of instability, to a sense of insecurity inside the regime.
Much of that instability stems from the very tough economic sanctions that the US has imposed on Iran since they withdrew from the nuclear agreement in 2018. How has Soleimani's death destabilised that agreement, do you think?
Well, the agreement has already been in the process of collapsing for at least 6 months. Every 60 days, the Iranians have been taking an extra step away from it as a way to pressure the rest of the people who are still in the agreement, so primarily the European powers, Germany, Britain and France, to find a way to relieve US sanctions on Iran, because Iran is really suffering. I mean, the cost of, for example, meat last year became 57% more expensive. That puts it out of reach of many poorer families. More than 1.6 million Iranians have fallen into poverty since the American sanctions were reimposed. I mean, these sanctions are designed to make the Iranian people suffer as a way to put pressure on their leaders. And so in the aftermath of the Soleimani killing, Iran took its latest step away from the nuclear deal. It said that it would no longer abide by the restrictions of the agreement when it came to sort of what it can and can't enrich. Essentially, the deal is now in free fall.
I mean, this feels incredibly worrying. How has the international community responded to this?
Well, this week, Britain, France and Germany triggered a dispute resolution mechanism within the nuclear deal, which means they formally complained that Iran is no longer in compliance with the agreement, and they sought talks to try to find a way to bring it back in. Now, the end point of this process that was started this week is that the deal is formally scrapped. The very tough international sanctions, not just the US sanctions, but the UN sanctions that were on Iran before the deal would be reimposed if this process is followed through.
The aim of the dispute resolution mechanism is not to reimpose sanctions. I think it has to be clear that the objective is therefore to find solutions and return to full compliance.
So what's going to happen now is that Iran and the parties to the nuclear deal will sit around a table, they'll mediate, they'll try and find some way to resolve this. But of course, the elephant in the room here is the US, which says that it will not sign a new agreement that relieves sanctions on Iran unless Iran agrees to a whole raft of new things. So curbs on its sponsorship of proxies in the Middle East, on missile development, and Iran has not given any indication that it wants to do that.
And what have we heard from the Iranian president, Hassan Rouhani?
Well, look, it's been a long, tough week for Hassan Rouhani, and the strain appeared to show in a cabinet meeting that he presided over a couple of days ago. He seemed angry, and he made an unusually angry threat. He said that
the American soldier is not secure today. Tomorrow, maybe the European soldier will not be secure. Let us address this insecurity.
And there are European troops in Bahrain, in Abu Dhabi, in Afghanistan. And that's the first time he's made a direct threat against Europeans since the nuclear deal began to collapse around 18 months ago. He struck that same combative tone on Thursday when he said that Iran was now enriching more uranium than it did before the nuclear deal. And why that matters is it all goes towards reducing what's called Iran's breakout time, which is the amount of time it will take Iran to produce 25 kilograms of weapons-grade uranium, and that's enough for one nuclear bomb.
This is an inflamed situation, and with tensions on the streets of Iran and suggestions by people like Boris Johnson that a new Iran nuclear deal should be negotiated.
President Trump is a great dealmaker, by his own account and many others. Let's work together to replace the JCPOA and get the Trump deal instead.
How is this playing out for Donald Trump?
Well, you know, other than the fact that 176 innocent people have been killed, I mean, which is something that is incredibly horrific, on a cold strategic level, you'd have to say that this is not going too badly for Donald Trump. You know, Iran has lost a significant military leader, someone responsible for many American deaths. He was touted as a possible future president of Iran.
He was the king of the roadside bombs. Great percentages of people don't have legs right now and arms because of this son of a...
The Iranian government has been exposed as having lied to its population. It's lost credibility. And now a wedge is being driven between Iran and Europe, which has so far opposed many American policies on Iran. On the other hand, the killing of Qasem Soleimani was a major event, and the strikes that we saw in Iraq last week will not be the end of Iran's revenge.
So what happens now?
Well, we don't expect to see any more military action, for example, the missile strikes we saw last week, but you might remember that last year there was this wave of suspicious attacks across the region. So there were these drones and missile strikes on Saudi oil facilities. Oil tankers in the Gulf suddenly started to have holes appear in their hulls and found themselves mysteriously disabled, and they couldn't quite say with precision, you know, who had done it. This is the kind of proxy of quiet attacks that Iran specializes in. And for Iran, it's about making a point. It's about saying, if we can't export oil, then no one can. And we're going to make it difficult for the entire oil industry in the Middle East to operate. We can also expect another violent year in Iraq. I mean, a lot of these Iran-backed militias who were in Iraq were loyal to Qasem Soleimani. He had helped to set them up. He had helped to supply and fund them. We don't expect that they will take his killing lying down. And so it's going to be another year of instability and danger in Iraq, but also across the broader Middle East.
What will this all mean for the Iranian people this year?
Iran is a complex society. It's very easy to kind of lump it together as just the regime against the Iranian people, but it isn't that simple. Iran has elections. It has an election coming up next month, and we can expect to see hardliners, so the people who are in favour of isolating Iran from the world, to make gains because... since the US pulled out of the Iran deal, that's been a huge blow to forces within Iran who have been arguing, quite successfully in some cases, for greater engagement with the world. The Iranian people will continue to suffer under sanctions, and that's going to lead to more unhappiness and eventually probably more unrest on the streets as well. So in Iran too, it's been a chaotic start to the year, but it's probably going to remain chaotic for the next 12 months.
Michael, thank you very much.
Thank you.
That was Michael Safi. Read all of his reporting on this story at theguardian.com, where you can also find an episode he made with us in November called Iran's Deadly Protests. Coming up, the 23-year-old MP who was living at home when she found out she'd won her seat. Now, 140 new MPs were elected to Parliament in December, and one of them was 23-year-old Nadia Whittam, the Labour member for Nottingham East. As the youngest MP of this cohort, she earned the title Baby of the House, and on winning her seat, said she would donate most of her £79,000 salary to local Nottingham charities. She'll still keep £35,000 a year, which she describes as a worker's wage. Here she reflects on her new role.
I don't think that anything can prepare you for being an MP. You expect it to be intense, but nothing can prepare you for the intensity of it. Parliament needs to reflect the diversity of the country, and currently it clearly doesn't. It feels like a very alien place to be as a young working class woman of colour, and on the one hand you feel very visible, on the other hand you feel invisible. One of the things I'm doing is reading Michael Foot's biography of Nye Bevan to see how Nye Bevan approached it when he was a new MP. He, like me, was young. He had radical socialist politics and he had a way of getting people to listen. There are quite a few MPs in their 20s in this parliament of the new intake. And I think that's a really positive thing because what we don't have in years of experience, we have in different experience. Actually, I've never moved away from home until becoming an MP, and that's not unusual for people in their 20s or even in their 30s now, actually, because we just can't afford to. So it feels very surreal moving out for the first time as I become an MP. I think what this election has taught us is that we can't just hand policies from on high. We need to build for them from the grassroots. People need to have a stake in them, ownership of them, and that happens at the most local level. But that's very difficult when our communities, our local councils, youth groups, all of those things that held us together have been cut. So our task now as the Labour Party is we're not in power for the next 5 years, but how can we give people power locally? How can we take power? What's prepared me best is all of the experiences of hardship that I've had to date, that I've overcome, and the fact that it's not just me there. It's me sitting on the green benches, it's my name on the ballot paper, but I didn't come here on my own. I'm from my community. I'm inspired by activists in Nottingham, my neighbours, my friends, my family, people whose names you don't even know, but are doing really fantastic work. So every time I start to feel frustrated, I know that I'm supported by loads of people who fighting for the same things that I'm fighting for.
That was Nadia Whittam. Thanks to her and to Michael Safi. Today's episode was produced by Rose de Larabiti and Courtney Youssef. Sound design was by Axel Cacoutier. The executive producers are Nicole Jackson and Phil Maynard. Have a really lovely weekend. We'll be back on Monday.